Hey everyone, welcome to a Patreon exclusive bonus episode of Chat Cemetery. I'm your host, Deanna Chapman, and I am joined by Nat Bremmer today to talk about The Dark Tower, The Gunslinger Born. It is one of the comic book adaptations that was released by Marvel. Nat, how are you doing today?
I am doing great. I'm excited to talk about this.
Yeah, this is the first of the Dark Tower comics that I've read, and obviously it's a good one to start with, you know, so there's that.
Yeah, it's the first that was released, and I haven't even been able to keep up with the amount that's come out since.
There's so many of them, and it was one of those things where I was like, I don't know if I want to do these as full episodes, because, you know, talking about anywhere from, let's say, 4 to 8 issues of a comic book isn't going to take terribly long. And granted, I have had some very short episodes just because certain movie adaptations don't require that much discussion. But I felt like the comics would be a great place to start with doing bonus episodes, because they are easier to get through than any Stephen King book that I've read.
Yep. Yep. And I think with this in particular, one of the things I like just about this comic and the fact that it exists is that I know, being a King fan all my life and having recommended it to people so many times, the Dark Tower is really daunting for some people and can be really hard for people to kind of dip their toes into.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think things like this serve as a really good primer on kind of the world and what to expect.
Oh, absolutely. And having the visual aspect to go along with it, too. And, you know, the trade paperback that I have, it collects the first 7 issues. And yep. Basically, each of these trades is kind of like its own little mini series, is what it really feels like. It's like you can read one and get a contained story. But this one in the back of it, it has maps. And I was like, yep. Ooh, I love me some maps, because that just helps put things into context and, you know, you get a better sense of location. Whereas I have read the main 7 Dark Tower books at this point. I have not read The Wind Through the Keyhole just yet, but I found myself not really ever knowing where exactly I was unless they were like, hey, you're in New York City, you dummy.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, having the visual aspect is because it's such a kind of specific kind of world, like the blending of Western pastiches with, you know, Tolkien-esque kind of fantasy and kind of Arthurian fantasy. It really helps having a visual representation of that, which is why I also love that so many of the books are illustrated.
Yeah, and to run down the credits real quick, because there are a lot of people credited on this book. Obviously, you have Stephen King, who is credited as the creative director and executive director. So he was definitely getting the scripts, at least for this one, which is noted in his sort of ending little speech that he did. Not speech, but he wrote it, as he does.
Yeah.
And you have the plotting and consultation by Robin Firth, who, if I'm not mistaken, wrote like the Dark Tower compendium or something along mm-hmm. those lines. So someone yep. who is definitely ingrained in the Dark Tower world. The script was by Peter David, with art by Jay Lee and Richard Isonov. I'm not 100% sure I'm correct pronouncing that correctly.
Yeah, Jay Lee, I know is correct, but Richard Isonov, I'm not totally sure.
I'm so bad with comic book creator names. I am the worst. And then you have lettering by Chris Eliopoulos. Wow. I should just stop while I'm ahead here. And I think this creative team works really well together, because Jay Lee's art in particular is just so stunning when it yes. comes to telling this big fantasy epic. And obviously, The Gunslinger Born is a story that focuses a lot on Roland becoming a gunslinger, hence the title, and him sort of going out on his first journey as a gunslinger. And you see that he's, what, 14 years old? And mm-hmm. he does not look 14 years old by any means.
I definitely made a note of that. He doesn't look 14 in any way whatsoever. But then, you know, I thought about it. I was like, that's actually kind of smart for Roland, because like I can imagine Roland being 2 and looking 10.
Yeah.
Like Roland's a character who to me absolutely always looked much older than he actually is.
He definitely looked and almost acted like he was in his early 20s, give or take, because, you know, he becomes a gunslinger and he goes and hooks up with the neighborhood prostitute, I guess.
Yes, almost immediately.
And that's when we find out he's 14. And I was like, hold on a minute, because granted, Stephen King does have a history of having characters go through things at much younger ages than they should.
Which I can confirm is absolutely, not for me in particular, but it's definitely a main thing.
Okay. Okay. That is helpful information. And even though The Dark Tower is obviously a story that does not take place in Maine,
yes,
you can see where that mindset comes from then.
Yes. Yeah. He may leave Maine, but it never leaves him.
Right. And how often does he really leave Maine?
Well, you know, so there are some books in Colorado and a couple now in Florida.
Yeah.
But no, you're right. And even, you know, that's what I loved reading the saga. I was like, eventually, as soon as I started The Dark Tower, I was like, eventually this thing's going to Maine. And it did.
It certainly did. It really did. And, you know, we won't spoil too much for anyone who hasn't read that insane amount of literature that Stephen King has provided us with. But with the comics, I think it's just nice to have them in these sort of bite-size forms, because when you're reading a Stephen King book, it can feel like 2 or 3 books in one, especially something as big as The Stand or even, you know, the last Dark Tower book. And by last, I mean the 7th one, not the one through the keyhole, because so much happens. And even in something like Wolves of the Cala, you have the whole story that is set in Caliber and Sturgis, which is one full story start to finish, and you have everything happening in New York that could technically almost be a second story on its own. And with this, you're kind of like, okay, we get to know Roland, his friends, Susan, and I think the portrayal of Susan in this is what really helped me get a grasp even more on who Roland is as a character.
Yeah, that's kind of the thing I wanted to talk about most, is like, we're not given a ton of new information in this comic. Like, this is kind of a rundown of like major moments from Wizard and Glass.
Yeah.
And as an introduction to Roland, I think it is really smart for this first comic story to really kind of centralize on his relationship with Susan and what it does to him, because I think, and it's tough not to talk about the saga as a whole, because this comic really jumps into the middle of the books, but I think more than more than his parents, more than even what happens with Jake in the first book, I think what happened to Susan is the trauma that Roland carries with him throughout the entire saga. And so I think kind of focusing on that for this first comic was a really smart introduction to who he is.
And it works in this format because you are getting all of those visual elements to it. If this was how the Dark Tower books started, I don't think it would have grabbed people as much. And I know that the Gunslinger book isn't necessarily a lot of people's favorites. I know some people who said they didn't really get into things until, you know, maybe the 3rd, 4th, or even 5th book. And for me, I thought the Gunslinger worked well because it showed this sort of weathered man on a journey. And this taking place in the midst of the books makes more sense for that format, because then it's like, okay, we're going to stop and give you some more context as to who Roland is. But when you already have that visual aspect and you're not getting it in flashback form, I think it's a powerful start to introduce a character.
Absolutely. Yeah, I definitely agree with that.
But for the novel, it's kind of like, okay, well, why do we care about this kid? Because I don't know if the comic necessarily does a better job of telling you that, but when you see how he is with Susan instead of just being told how he is with Susan. It's more powerful.
Yeah, I also think the Gunslinger, the novel, the first book, really worked as it did because it was a much smaller scale kind of story. You know, it's the Gunslinger and the Man in Black, and you know he's the Gunslinger, and you know he's after the Man in Black. And that's really great for a first book because that doesn't overwhelm you with mythology, which kind of grows as the books do. Because even here, even with the visual aspect, like with as much of the world as you're getting in this comic, it still kind of needs this narrator to kind of keep everything in order.
It absolutely does. And you have some comics that are just too wordy, I think, as well. And I don't know if you've read any of King's script work, like his script for Storm of the Century, for instance.
Yes, I really loved listening to your episode on that of the podcast, because I've known a lot of people who were like, you know, the script for Storm of the Century, they're like, oh, I didn't even know like that this script was like available. Like, you know, I've heard people like down here in Florida who are like, I found it in a bookstore. And I was like, I didn't know any of his scripts were like sold. But like growing up, like in the town that was shot when it was coming out, the script for Storm of the Century was everywhere. It was sold in literally every store.
Yeah.
So like I got a copy. It was probably the first script I ever read. And so, because I was young, I had no idea, like, that's not normally what you do. But now, like, as a screenwriter, I know for sure that that is not what you do.
Yeah, it's funny. I look at that one sitting on my shelf, and then I see, like, The Green Mile and the Shawshank ones that I happened upon. And I'm just like, man, he was really wordy in comparison to actual screenwriters. And it's hard to fault him, because at the time, writing for TV wasn't exactly new to him, but it's not like Stephen King is a seasoned script writer. Even today,
for sure.
And, you know, in the piece he has at the end of the comic here, he even says he wants to do comics. He wants to actually write comics. And the bonus episode I actually ended up releasing first for Patreon subscribers was American Vampire. And I wanted to do that one because it was him actually writing a comic. Granted, he was co-writing it with Scott Snyder, but I felt like that was a good place to start if you wanted to dive into Stephen King's comic book work. And here you have Peter David, who is a pretty well-known name in comics.
Yes. Yeah, that's a major, that's another thing I want to point out. Like, that's a major comic book writer to kind of kick this off with. And I don't think it's any coincidence. Like, you can tell just in that kind of open letter at the end that it really sparked a fire in him for comics. And I don't think it's any coincidence that American Vampire came just a couple years later.
Yeah, not at all. And, you know, Peter David has written The Incredible Hulk, some Aquaman issues. He's done a lot of Spider-Man issues. So he is someone who takes on these big works for Marvel in particular. And, you know, with The Dark Tower, it's certainly something that is a massive undertaking, because
huge.
You know, I have not seen the 2017 Dark Tower movie, but I have heard how not great it is. And I think it's because you can't really take any one part of this story and make it into its own standalone thing. It needs to be part of a bigger picture. And given how many Dark Tower comics there are now, you know that Marvel understood that.
Yeah. And it's funny that you bring up the adaptation, because another note I made is sadly, I don't think we'll ever know for sure, but I earnestly feel like this comic is the closest we have to what I imagine the Amazon series probably looked like.
Yeah, I'm really bummed that we won't get to find out. But the fact that we do at least have this sort of visual adaptation of it makes me happy, because, you know, there's this, and this is part of the Dark Tower Beginnings, which contains six different Dark Tower trades. Then you have the Dark Tower, the Gunslinger, which contains 8 different ones, I think. And then you have the Drawing of the Three, which obviously, you know, the Gunslinger and the Drawing of the Three are book titles as well.
Mm-hmm. It's a huge undertaking, but I'm also glad that it was clearly the response to it was great enough for it to spark that many, like, impossible to keep up with comic titles.
Yeah, these basically came out for 10 years straight.
Yeah, and like, you know, Jai Lee's art in particular, I think, is so cinematic for this. And it was such, that was such a smart get of an artist for this, because it's exactly what I feel like the Dark Tower should be, in that it is cinematic. It is, you know, it feels almost like a movie, but it's also very kind of surreal art at the same time. And I really enjoy that balance. Although, you know, if I have any kind of small gripe with the art there, it's that I noticed that a couple times some characters, like Elder Jonas in particular, he'll look like a scary, you know, creep of an old man.
Mm-hmm.
But then there'll be some panels where he kind of looks like a 20-something guy with like a wig,
yeah,
and a fake mustache. But for the most part, like the art is great. And another thing, because you brought up the open letter at the end, King's kind of letter at the end,
uh-huh,
is that I absolutely love that he goes through these ideas for comics he would love to do. Like, he's running through ideas for comics,
yeah,
and then one of them is 11/22/63.
Right.
And I love, like, that's kind of the first I'd ever seen of 11/22/63. I love the idea that what is maybe his most highly regarded modern work started as an idea for a comic book.
Yeah, it's fascinating the way this man's brain works sometimes. And yes, you can see that there's still an interest there in comics, because during this, too, you had the Stand comics. There was, mm-hmm, a Talisman comic that came out towards the end of the Dark Tower run. You have Stephen King's N, and apparently there's supposed to be a Sleeping Beauties comic this year, which I don't know if COVID kind of messed with that schedule. I'll have to look into it, because I'm not 100% sure who was supposed to be releasing that. It could have been IDW or a different publisher that's still fairly big, but not one of the big two. And I'm very interested in seeing if he returns to comics in a more original capacity instead of it just being adaptations of his previous works.
Yeah. Yeah. I would definitely agree to that. I would really like to see that.
Yeah, because I think, well, one, his son Joe Hill has proven that you can do both, and he has, you know, Nosferatu that was adapted, and Lock and Key is now a Netflix show. And while I have not finished reading the Lock and Key comics, there are so many horror stories you can tell that I think, mm-hmm, would actually make a better transition by going from comic book to big or small screen.
Yeah. Yeah. I am earnestly surprised, especially in kind of the way King likes to experiment and the way he doesn't mind kind of jumping on other people's things. Like, even in this letter, you've mentioned how much he'd love to write like a Spider-Man comic.
Yeah.
I am genuinely surprised that he never wrote any Lock and Key.
Yeah. It is kind of crazy considering he does like to collaborate with his children.
Yes, extremely.
And to bring things back to the Gunslinger Born, one thing that I really love talking about with comics is not only the artwork, but how the colors work with that artwork. Because you have so many times where, you know, you're kind of having these darker moments, and just the color palette of a bunch of these scenes.
Yeah.
It looks so, so good.
Yeah. Oh, my God. So, like, comic book colorists, I think, the most kind of underrated people in comics, because they do, you know, they put in so much work, and they're basically, you know, they're cinematographers. There's a lighting department. They're figuring out a lot of the mood accompanying the artwork, and I love some of the visual palette of this, and especially some of the repeating kind of color. Like, there's a lot of green fog and stuff.
Yeah.
And I love the visual tones things take around, you know, Walter O'Dim, Martin Broadcloak. Like,
mm-hmm.
things always get like this kind of creepy, foggy kind of forest vibe whenever he's on the screen. And I think, yeah, the color really stands out in that area and really creating a mood on this.
And it looks like Richard Isenoff is the one who did a lot of the coloring work, because in the very back of My Trade, there's the painted process. And you see this picture he had taken in France, and he tweaked it until he got sort of that red orange tone to it. And you see how he placed that into a particular scene in the comic book. And by the time you get to the finished product, it's just so amazing, the sort of textures. And like you said, they're basically the people doing the lighting. You're seeing how the light reflects off of these people's faces. You're seeing how the fog affects things. And one of the moments in particular where I think this really shines, other than in sort of the scenery splash pages and stuff, is that big battle between Roland and his friends and Jonas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I definitely agree with that. And I think, like, there's such a kind of yellowed, kind of dusty feel, like, to the canyons, to the town, and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just flipping through, like I mentioned, some of the kind of the blue tones over Martin. But mm-hmm. Just the art in general, I think, does so much of the legwork on this in any comic story. And, like, I think one of my favorite little moments, particularly because I love, Randall Flagg, Martin Broadcloak, et cetera, as a character, is this bit where he is in communication with the Crimson King, and he just finishes. And it's one of those rare moments where he's, like, by himself, and he looks, you just see him from the back. He's, like, old and decrepit.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the troops kind of come in, and he spins around. And, like, as he's shocked and spinning around to face him, he gets young again in, like, a single panel. And it's so great to see, you know, to see that and kind of emphasize that every single thing about this character is a performance.
Right.
And, like, just those little details in the art I was extremely impressed by.
Yeah, this was the first time I had ever picked up one of the Dark Tower comics, other than to maybe thumb through some in a comic book shop when I happened mm-hmm. upon them. But I really thought that the whole thing came together well, because you have to have a good script, and then you have to have an artist and colorist who work really well together. Otherwise, if one aspect of the book is off, it can kind of ruin the whole thing for you. I know I've read certain comics where maybe the artist had to take an issue off or something for whatever reason, due to scheduling, or they just weren't available at sort of the schedule that DC had hoped for. So they bring in artists who only do, you know, one or two issues in a story arc. And sometimes the change can be so abrupt that it'll take me out of the story completely. And I think, you know, this being as cohesive as it is really helped how much I enjoyed it, because I absolutely love this way more than I thought I would.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And I totally agree with that. That's a big pet peeve of mine in comics. Like, I know scheduling and circumstances, like, are what they are, but mm-hmm. sometimes the art will change in the middle of, like, an issue.
Yeah.
And that drives me crazy. Like, a story arc is one thing. I like that to be, like, cohesive. But when when the artist changes, like, in the middle of a single comic, I'm like, guys, please don't do this to me.
Yeah, sometimes I'll see, you know, the credits at the beginning of the book, and it's like, oh, so-and-so did page 9 through 16, and you're like,
yeah,
but why? It's one thing if it's, you know, one of those oversized issues where it's 100 pages, and it's like 5 different stories by 5 different creative teams, and that's totally different. We're talking about, you know, in one cohesive story, it's just so jarring sometimes.
Yeah, for sure. Another thing, getting back to this kind of comic story, one thing that was a little jarring to me, I kind of get why they did it, because the book series was basically over at this point. But, with having read through the books and kind of the way it's drawn out, it is really surprising for you to just get a full blatant appearance of the Crimson King mm-hmm. in this comic. I know in on one hand that it was, it's a totally different structure. It's a totally different thing. And it is on one hand kind of interesting to do that so early on, but it felt much less kind of mysterious. It didn't have that same kind of buildup, and it just gave, in this comic at least, gave Martin and the Crimson King much more of a kind of Vader Emperor relationship.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that was good or bad. I think it definitely works, but it was definitely surprising to see.
I totally agree. And it was one of those things where I was kind of trying to remember back to Roland's flashbacks in Wizard and Glass. And I was like, okay, we're getting the Susan scenes. And then it's like, well, we're also getting stuff that I'm not sure he would necessarily know about. But I felt the same way with a lot of his stories in the books too. I was like, how would Roland know this though? And you kind of just have to be like, well, because Stephen King said so, and we have to go with it.
Mm-hmm. Which, I mean, literally, I don't want to give, but once he kind of enters things in the books themselves, that adds a whole other layer, because it's like, oh, does that mean that, like, even in the context of the story, it's like, oh, is this embellished because Stephen King did it, or did Stephen King embellish it and that changed the world around them to be embellished?
Right. So many questions when it comes to decisions that Stephen King makes. But Nat, is there anything else in particular you wanted to talk about before we wrap up here?
Like you said, this was really pleasant surprise. Like, I read this a long time ago, and I kind of never picked it back up off the shelf, and reading it again, I really enjoyed what this is and the way it serves as a comic book introduction to the Dark Tower.
Yeah.
I think it might be probably the best adaptation of the Dark Tower we're ever going to see at this point.
It was immediately like a 5 out of 5 for me once I finished reading it, because I was like, this is what I want, but like in movie or TV form.
Yeah. Exactly.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining me for a Patreon bonus episode. There will be plenty more to come. I won't be doing them every single week because I probably should have started these sooner than I did. So I'm thinking, we'll do about 2 a month here if I can find enough people who have read the comics. They seem to be lesser known than I think a lot of the other kinds of adaptations.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. Well, thank you for having me, and any of these I'd be happy to do.
You will certainly be back on for more, because I will be bugging whoever I can to do them with me.
All right, sounds good.